Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. It's Legal Roundtable Day, and it's a busy season for lawyers and the courts. There is a lot to talk about locally and regionally, but I don't think we can ignore the elephant in the room, the latest of the ongoing Washington allegations concerning the Trump administration and Russia. We learned over the weekend that the family of the president seems directly involved, as son-in-law Jared Kushner is accused of trying to work out a secret communications arrangement with the Kremlin. Some say that if true, it could amount to espionage. With me to talk about it and other things are attorneys Mark Smith, Bill Freivogel, and back with us once again, Rachel Sachs. Mark and Rachel are with Washington University. She teaches law. He directs the Career Center and is Associate Vice Chancellor of Students. Bill teaches journalism at SIU in Carbondale. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Hi.
Good to be back.
Yeah.
Normally we talk about local things pretty much on the Legal Roundtable. There's so much going on in Washington. I think we have to pay a little bit of attention to that and try to sort some things out. One of the things that I mentioned in the introduction was that there is an allegation out there that what has been going on with, allegedly going on with Jared Kushner amounts to espionage, and that comes from the former acting CIA director John McLaughlin, responding to those reports that Kushner set up this communication deal with the Kremlin. Anybody, that's a tough word to be using in any kind of a context here. Does anybody want to address that? Is that perhaps too strong a term? Does it seem right?
Well, I think it's a pretty strong term to be throwing out at this point based on what we know. I do think, however, it is very the thing that's particularly strange about what Kushner seems to have been doing was trying to set up this communications channel using Russian facilities, either in the embassy or some other Russian facility, to seemingly avoid the conversations being overheard by our own intelligence officials. So I guess that's where this idea that maybe it could be espionage comes from. But I think it's way too early. It's way too early to use that term, which is espionage is a crime. I don't think it's too early to say that this has been an extraordinary 100-plus days in which the president has, in an unprecedented way, taken after the two main checks of his power, the press and the courts. And done it in a very extraordinary way. He calls real news outlets fake news outlets. He calls fake news outlets real news outlets. He calls the seemingly established fact that the Russians sought to interfere in the election campaign on the side of President Trump. He calls that fake news when it's obviously well established by multiple intelligence agencies. So it's an extraordinary first days of a presidency, and he has managed to already put his presidency at risk in that period of time.
Going back to the use of the term espionage, when I think of that, what I'm normally thinking of is the passing of secrets. And, nothing like that has been alleged. Is that the way, Rachel, is that the way you would look at it?
Well, I'm not a national security expert, but I can only say that every day at 5 p.m., I know there's another news story going to drop, and it just seems as if there's a steady drip, drip, drip of stories, which we get more and more detail about these things every day. So I agree that it has not yet been alleged that any secrets have been passed. I don't believe that the back channel was actually established.
No,
I think it was just
exactly.
talked about.
Exactly.
But I wouldn't be shocked if it came out in a few days or a week's time that secrets were actually passed by an official in the administration, especially in light of what we've now learned about the president's Oval Office meeting with the Russians just a couple of weeks ago his disclosure of confidential information therein.
You raise an interesting question because if the back channel has not been established, can there be a crime?
Right. Yeah, because we don't know if anything – I mean, that's the whole thing with this. We don't know what really has happened. So even with the and that's what a lot of Trump's defenders are saying. Well, we haven't seen any facts yet. But I think as they investigate – I'm not saying that we'll necessarily find that Kushner passed on state secrets. Mm-hmm. I personally think that's doubtful. But I think I think we're going to see more conversations. What I find interesting, and this is not so much of a legal issue, but it's, you know, Kushner was viewed as kind of the voice of reason, and as the person, you know, who could control Trump and maybe who stood up to Bannon and maybe some of the more right-wing elements. But now the stuff that's coming out is suggesting he was, you know, pushing for Comey's firing, that he was advising Trump to react more strongly to Mueller's appointment, and that was not how I pictured him before. So,
Don, the Espionage Act is 100 years old. It was passed in 1917 during World War I, time of, you know, great fear, and it's very broadly worded. It's so broadly worded that to be applied constitutionally, there has to be, you know, proof of specific intent. So there would have to be intent that you're trying to help another country. You know, espionage was the issue in connection with Hillary Clinton and the email server. That's, you know, what she would have been charged with had she been charged with anything. So it's but, you know, it requires a lot more evidence. Mm.
I would just make a point with regard to Rachel's comment, waiting until 5 p.m. to find out what's going on. Actually, you can get it at 6 a.m. if you're with Twitter. Because now that he's back from overseas, the Twitter account is active once again. Mm-hmm. Okay, so much to talk about. Let's go to General Flynn. He is invoking the Fifth Amendment with regard to his turning over documents concerning his association with Russia during the campaign. Is that a reasonable defense, do you think, the claiming violation of self-incrimination? You're shaking, Rachel, you're shaking your head.
No, it's just it's very strange because we're talking here about documents. We're not talking about personal testimony. And so Congress has now, of course, gone on to subpoena the documents from a corporation that Flynn himself controls. And the corporation is itself, I believe, unable to take the Fifth Amendment. So they'll get it one way or another. And it's just sort of a little strange to see him do that so publicly here.
Yeah. So oftentimes we think of the Fifth Amendment as something verbal, rather than
right.
A document.
I mean, I think it comes into play in connection with documents is, you know, potentially you could make a claim that if Congress were asking him to create a new document that, say, summarized all of his contacts with the Russians, that would be testimonial. Or if Congress cannot, you know, particularly describe the documents that it's seeking, you know, it has a very vague kind of description of them instead of a very specific description, then the production of them could be considered testimonial. But in general, you know, I agree with Rachel that
But in the letter from Covington, his law firm, that they said that producing the documents would be equivalent to testifying that the documents exist, which – I didn't find particularly persuasive, but that was their argument.
That's what lawyers do. Right?
Yeah,
they muddy those
make
waters.
Arguments, right? Yeah.
Anything else with regard to?
But I think there's a good chance they'll be able to find a lot of these documents were within the government. They don't have to get them from Flynn necessarily. I think there may be other ways that they'll come out, and I suspect that's what they'll try and do.
I agree. But I think that I think General Flynn's in a lot of trouble. But you know, as we know more about what Jared Kushner was doing with the Russians in early December, I mean it's a little bit you know hard trying to put together what is the whole picture here. You know, if Kushner's doing things in connection with the Russians in early December, and then Flynn is in late December, isn't this all part of like one effort? And could they be doing this without the president's knowledge?
And I was actually more troubled by the allegations about Flynn's dealings with Turkey not being disclosed. And is there a relationship with those to the Russian investigation? I'm not sure. It's very possibly not. But that in itself, I think, is very important and worth considering.
Yeah, both Kushner and Flynn failed initially to disclose these, you know, various connections, Flynn with Turkey and Russia, Kushner with Russia and with a banker. From Russia. Yeah, they later changed their disclosure statement, said they just didn't. You know.
Since the last time we got together, former FBI Director Comey has been fired. There is a local connection there, Mark, right?
Yeah, so we have to promote Washington University School of Law. Andrew McCabe, the acting director, or is that his term, acting? Or it's acting, not interim. is a class of 1993 graduate of Washington University. So I think he went to Duke undergrad and WashU Law School, and went to a big firm and then went over to the FBI and has had a pretty rapid rise within the FBI. So that's our local connection to it.
Any comment with regard to Comey? I know a lot of people are looking forward to his testimony on Capitol Hill, which should be coming fairly quickly.
Well, I do think that Trump, apparently on Kushner's advice, firing Comey was a terrible mistake. You know, how they could not have realized they were making a terrible mistake, I don't know. Firing the person who's in charge of the investigation of the White House and campaign activities that's what sort of brought us back to all of these sort of Watergate comparisons. You know, of course, you can criticize Comey for the way he handled the Hillary Clinton email situation. But I have to say, in connection with this investigation, he seems to have been pretty careful. I mean, you know, there were stories about how he would rehearse for his meetings with Trump because he feared that Trump was going to try to sort of, you know, compromise him. And then as soon as he left the meetings with Trump, he immediately memorialized the conversations. Which is what FBI agents do. But
what's what lawyers do a lot of times. I mean, you know, I've had some of my friends say, well, that just doesn't make sense that he would come out of a meeting. But, I mean, as a lawyer, you would come out of a meeting or you have a phone call and then you do a memo to the file just because you can't remember all this stuff. So you would say, I said that I would do this. They said they would do this. And you have a nice little paper record. That's what lawyers do. So the idea that he has all these things, I mean, it's not surprising, I think, to most lawyers that he would be keeping all these records.
If I were Trump, I'd be very unnerved by the close relationship between Comey and Mueller. There's the sort of story of Comey and Mueller rushing across the District of Columbia to get to the hospital where John Ashcroft was to keep Ashcroft from signing off on what they thought was an illegal and unconstitutional wiretapping program. At the time, Ashcroft was under a lot of pressure from Alberto Gonzalez and Andrew Card, and they were also on their way to the White House. So, you know, that is sort of a bond between those two, like, very professional people who I think consider their integrity and nonpartisanship to be key to their identity.
And for those who are not familiar with this story, I'd recommend actually a Politico profile I read recently called What Donald Trump Needs to Know About Bob Mueller and Jim Comey, which goes through this story and Comey's testimony about it in some detail. And it's really a page-turner. These are men who have spent decades in public service, who spent decades writing memos after these meetings. And the existence of those memos is actually one of the least surprising things, to anyone who's spent time thinking about these men, and I hope that some of them are able to be publicly released.
So another interesting legal issue with Mueller, he came from a firm called WilmerHale, and that law firm represented some of the involved peoples, Kushner and I'm blanking on the name of the campaign guy. But anyway, he never did legal work for them, but the law firm did.
And Manafort.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Thank you. And there's a suggestion that may create a conflict where he can't investigate them and then they would try and divide the investigation among a number of people. Now, my understanding is the Justice Department can waive that
I thought there was an ethics clearance that already happened.
It's been cleared.
Okay,
yes,
good.
It has been cleared. Yeah.
Well, let's take a break. There's more to come, and we'll continue the conversation in a moment. It's Legal Roundtable Day. With me in studio is Rachel Sachs, Washington University School of Law, Mark Smith, also from Washington University, and Bill Freivogel, professor of journalism at SIU Carbondale. They are all attorneys, and we're talking the law today. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. While we're talking about some of these national issues, has anyone here seen anything that would indicate how quickly Mr. Mueller might be able to might be able to come to some conclusions about everything that's going on. It seems everything that I've heard seems to indicate it's going to be maybe a couple of years. Sound right?
It'll definitely be months, many months. Probably, you know, most of these special counsel investigations do last for years. You know, we think of the. I mean, it was a different. It was an independent counsel. You know, Ken Starr and the Iran-Contra investigation took forever. But I think it's safe to say months.
Into the 2018 election year, undoubtedly.
Yeah, but we may get, it seems like we're getting, I mean, I've never seen so many leaks out of law enforcement, intelligence, the White House itself. It's amazing.
You bring us to something else I wanted to discuss, because over the weekend on Meet the Press, the man who runs the Department of Homeland Security, Kelly, said on that program that these persistent leaks, again, another tough word being thrown around here, these persistent leaks in his mind amount to treason.
Okay, it's definitely not treason. Treason is a crime, and the Constitution has very specific requirements. It is, speaking of espionage, though, it is espionage. For a government official who has promised to keep secrets, to leak top secret information to a reporter, that is a violation of the Espionage Act. For the reporter to take it and to publish it is not. No reporter or journalist has ever been prosecuted or charged under the Espionage Act for printing information that was national security secrets. I mean, this is a way in which the United States is a lot different from Britain. You know, one of the things, Britain was real mad about some of the details of the Manchester bombing being leaked out through U.S. sources to American media. You know, Britain has an Official Secrets Act. It says, you know, they can stop people from printing. We have the Pentagon Papers decision that says the government cannot stop the publication of information absent extraordinary circumstances that threaten immediate threat to national security, like a military operation, name of a spy, the formula for the hydrogen bomb. You know, those would be the exceptions. And almost anything else. You can't. The Pentagon Papers is a 40-plus volume top secret history of the Vietnam War. The Supreme Court said you can't stop that publication.
Any of the others here have anything to say about the treason comment?
Just to say that many of these leaks are coming from within the White House itself. Right. And I think it's unfortunate that we see the president tweeting about the need to find and stop the leakers and the threat to national security when we know that many of his own aides are going on background to these reporters and revealing a lot of this information themselves. So I don't have a sense of what the balance is of leaks between the White House and the national security apparatus, but he must know that much of this is coming from his own staff.
And the same thing happened with Obama. I mean, we had leaks and they tried to plug them as well. So it's not unusual. It's kind of the American way that we have this leaking. I mean, I, like Bill said, different than the British approach.
Max Frankel was a really famous New York Times editor, and he wrote this to the Supreme Court during the Pentagon Papers. Without the use of secrets, there could be no adequate diplomatic, military, and political reporting of the kind our people take for granted, either abroad or in Washington. And I agree with that.
Let's take a call. Jay is going to join us from Normandy. He wants to get into this part of the conversation, then we'll move on. Go ahead, Jay.
Well, hi, guys. I'd be curious to know what publication that was that your lady attorney said we should read about Comey and Mueller. So that's number one. I'd like her to say that. But isn't it pretty clear that Trump has obstructed justice by telling people to back off on this Flynn investigation? I mean, it seems clear, and the Russian investigation. So it seems like you ought to have a big concern.
Jay, thanks. Does it rise to the level of obstruction of justice, is telling people to back off?
Well, I mean, I think you could make the argument that it's obstruction of justice. I think we need more information to know sort of the whole context. Intents is important here as well. You know, there's obstruction of justice, which is a crime, and then there's also obstruction of justice that could be considered to be an impeachable offense, which might not have the same requirements. But definitely for him to say he was thinking about the Russia investigation when he fired Comey. And to ask Comey previously to lay off Flynn, those things come pretty close to obstruction of justice.
To providing that specific intent that you were talking about with the other crime.
And Rachel, it was?
It was Politico. Thank you, Jay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A recent publication of Politico?
Yes, I believe last week or the week before.
Okay. One other thing I just want to mention, then we'll move on to some of the local things we have on the list here. President Trump has lost once again on the issue of the travel ban. And now Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, is saying he's going to take it to the Supreme Court. So it looks like that's where this is ultimately going to be resolved.
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I think the Supreme Court is highly likely to grant cert here, even if there ends up not being a circuit split at the lower courts, because the Supreme Court generally reviews lower court decisions striking down federal actions as unconstitutional. And so if it chooses not to take the case, that in itself will be a big statement. And there are lots of questions in the case. You know, one I think is worth flagging is about how much, if at all, the court can look beyond the face of the order to determine discriminatory intent. So if the order isn't called a Muslim ban, what can the court look to determine that it is one? So his pre-election statements, his post-election statements, what's valid? And one note to remember here is that the order in the Korematsu case, right, the case in which the Supreme Court upheld the order that led to Japanese-American internment during World War II, it didn't on its face mention Japanese-Americans. And so it's very similar to the situation here. Here it's even arguably more extreme because you have a list of countries. But to the extent we can expect the current court to repudiate Korematsu fairly clearly, they would do the same for this case as well.
Is there any doubt, would you think, that if the Sessions does take it this way, that the court would accept this case?
Well, I think they probably would accept it. But, you know, so this was a decision of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals on the East Coast. And we're awaiting a decision, at least I haven't seen that there's been one yet, from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the one that Trump is always beating up upon, and how it will rule on the same question. And the other thing to keep in mind is that we're in the sort of pre-trial stage here. These are like emergency orders. So I think the Supreme Court will at least let things play out a little bit and see what the Ninth Circuit says. If the Ninth Circuit disagrees with the Fourth Circuit and says that the ban is constitutional, that would make it probably even more likely that they would, when there's a split of the circuits, that's when the Supreme Court, takes it. That'd be a question, do they take it? Do they issue some sort of an opinion just based on these emergency proceedings, or do they wait until there's a trial and the whole thing is argued out? I don't know.
And to reverse my understanding is you'd need to get five of the justices to reverse the emergency ban on his order. So four just to hear the case. In this case, it was interesting, and it's similar to what came out of Hawaii. They point to these campaign statements that we're going to keep Muslims out, that they characterize as anti-Muslim statements. And then they said the order, like you said, which doesn't talk about Muslims, it just talks about these countries, it says in context, and given these statements that were made before, it drips with animus and discrimination. So, you know, which makes me wonder, I mean, does that mean – you know, he said these things during the campaign. We always kind of expect candidates to be a little out there. Does this mean he can never kind of do an order like this? Because, I mean, is he tainted for the rest of time or the rest of his term to do anything like this? Because...
So what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals decided was that this was an establishment of religion. In violation of the First Amendment. And they likened it to a case, I think it's called McCleary from Kentucky, where a judge, you know, had put up the Ten Commandments in his courtroom and they took them down after he got in trouble about it and then put them back up with, you know, a bunch of other religious texts also on the wall. And the Supreme Court said, you know, it's not like we wake up every morning and don't remember what happened before. Mm-hmm. And this judge said the very same thing in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's not like we forget all these statements that were made during the campaign and during the transition when we make a decision on whether this is an establishment of religion.
And just to respond to Mark's point about whether President Trump could ever issue an order like this if we consider all of his pre-election statements, I think the answer is yes, but he has to be a better client for his lawyers, right? So if he had notified the Justice Department ahead of time that he was doing this, if he had proceeded to gather a record about threats coming from these particular countries as compared to other countries, that could all be used to support an order like this. But he did none of those things, right? And famously, as we're now hearing, he didn't even tell the Justice Department before issuing it, essentially. And so these kinds of things support the conclusion that it wasn't based on the kind of evidence we look to in these cases.
One of the things that people are going to point to, you know, it was a split on the Fourth Circuit.
10-3.
Yeah, 10-3. And all 10 of the majority were had been appointed by Democrats, and the three dissenters had been appointed by Republicans. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure some folks will try and make hay of that.
I would expect the Supreme Court to be more receptive to the Trump administration than the appeals courts that have heard this case before.
I think so, too.
Well, simply because of the 5-4 mix.
Yeah, partly that. And you know, there should be deference to the president when it comes to immigration and when it comes to national security. The trouble is with these countries that he's named, there have been none or virtually no terrorist incidents that have resulted from people coming from those countries, as the Court of Appeals said.
Yeah.
One other issue that has strong national overtones but local as well is the issue of health care and the Affordable Care Act. And Rachel, I know you something has caught your attention with regard to that that involves us right here in Missouri.
Of course. So I study health law, so this is one I'm tracking closely. Well, despite what you may have heard, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare is still good law. So the House has passed its repeal bill, but the Senate hasn't come out with its bill so far. And there's a lot of uncertainty about what the rules of the market will be next year for people who get their insurance on the individual exchanges. And this is a problem because insurance companies that want to sell on the individual market are filing their plans and rates right now. And so they need to know what the rules will be. And just last week, we got the news that Blue Cross Blue Shield of Kansas City announced that it's withdrawing from the individual market for 2018, citing this exact uncertainty about what the rules are going to be next year. And so that leaves 25 counties without any insurers on the individual exchanges and tens of thousands of people in western Missouri without a coverage option for next year. So when there were situations like this arising in the Obama administration, there was a big effort by the administration to find insurers who would step into these markets. I'm not so sure that the current administration will see that as a priority. And over the next few weeks, I'll be watching to see what happens.
And I guess we can multiply those thousands by thousands more in other states where the same sort of thing is going on, because it is happening elsewhere, isn't it?
It is, although in some markets we've seen insurers exit and other insurers come to take their place. So that was a situation in some other states that have happened already.
Okay. Well, another discussion for another day that will probably be going on for a good many months to come. Let's move on now to some of the things more directly affecting Missouri. A lot of people are upset because a circuit court judge in Cole County has ruled on the sex offender GPS system that has been in use for some years now. The state has been temporarily stopped from enforcing new monitoring requirements on these sex offenders. I'm not quite sure that we all understand what is going on here, except that apparently there was a retroactivity issue that offenders whose cases went through the court system prior to January 1st can have those GPS tracking devices removed. Is it a retroactivity issue?
Yeah, it's an ex post facto, an issue of ex post facto law, a law that a punishment that is occurring after the fact. You know, there was this, like, you remember we talked a few years ago about this new criminal code that was put into effect. And apparently after the new criminal code went into effect that recategorized some of these sex offenses, then the legislature passed something on these ankle recorders that had the effect of having the recorders required for some people who had already left court supervision, like maybe 300 people who had already left court supervision. So, you know, they've served their time, they're done, and suddenly now the state's coming back and saying you have to put these on. In April, they put these ankle ankle bracelets on a bunch of these offenders, and now a judge has said this is ex post facto law. It's interesting that that Senator Dixon, who I believe is a Republican, and who was in charge of that redoing of the criminal code, said, you know, this never had been the intended effect. It clearly couldn't. It couldn't happen. You couldn't have this kind of ex post facto application.
And there have been a number of cases in other parts of the country dealing with this question of what is a retroactive punishment and what's permitted. And I know courts have gone different ways on certain things depending on where offenders are in their cycle of supervision. So for some people who are on supervised release but are still within the system, there's been discussion about extending the monitoring term that they're already on, and that may be viewed as different from people who've already completed their rehabilitation, and we don't believe there's a reason for them to be still monitored.
But the bottom line at the present moment is that several hundred convicted sex offenders are now out there without the
But many sex offenders still are still being monitored. So it just applied to a subset of crimes.
Who didn't have them on before.
Before, exactly.
Okay. All right, let's move on. Planned Parenthood, back in the news. It never really goes away, it seems. But the St. Louis Board of Aldermen is going to consider legislation that would create a buffer zone. I think it's an 8-foot bubble, they call it, outside of the Planned Parenthood facility here in St. Louis. This would keep people who are protesting abortions, right to life folks, from getting close to women who are going there to either have an abortion or to talk about it. This is being challenged by those people who are protesting the abortions, claiming it is a violation of free speech because they are not able to consult those folks, as they call it, as they are going in.
And there was a Supreme Court case, like 3 or 4 years ago out of Boston, I think. But there the bubble was much larger. This seems to be more restricted. A Colorado case or something?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. There's a Colorado case that went up to the Supreme Court, which involves a buffer zone of approximately this size, which was upheld. So I think that's what they're modeling this after. And the Supreme Court, you know, sort of said you don't need to be able to reach into someone's car or block a driveway to exercise your free speech rights.
And so you can still what is it, 8 feet?
Yes.
So 8 feet away, I can still talk to people, yell to people, but not stand in the way. And I think there were issues with people or the allegations of people were in the driveway, blocking cars, things like that.
Mm-hmm. That's right. there could be a bubble. It just can't be so big.
It can't be a huge bubble, right.
Have to take another break. Let's do that now. We'll come back and continue our legal discussion with Rachel Sachs, Mark Smith, and Bill Freivogel. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Bill Freivogel, Mark Smith, and Rachel Sachs, our legal roundtable panelists. The headline there with regard to that Confederate monument, just wanted to ask you guys if you see anything any legal issue concerning the removal or the potential removal of this monument.
So the city of St. Louis should decide to remove the monument. Would not be violating anybody's free speech. They would be speaking on behalf of the people of the city of St. Louis, saying they don't approve of this monument to what many people feel is a monument to slavery. I might point out that the monument was erected during a time when all sorts of other racist things were going on in the city of St. Louis. This was 1912, but 1916 was a race riot. 1916, city of St. Louis passed a law that said blacks couldn't live next to whites. So that was what was going on in the city of St. Louis.
Yeah. This was on the 50th anniversary of the end of the Civil War, so I guess it would have been 1915, even closer to some of the other things that were going on. My impression was someone is raising the issue that it can only be removed if the Board of Aldermen votes to remove it, because it was the Board of Aldermen that okayed the
monument. And the Board of Aldermen, there was a bill introduced, I think, last week, that said they want to, within 30 days, a list of all Confederate monuments and parks, unless they're in the museums. They want the Confederate Drive in Forest Park, which I didn't even know was there was a street named
it's about
that.
100 yards long.
Oh, is it? Well, it's going to be they want to change to Scott Joplin Road or whatever, and then but it was interesting because then they authorized the raising of private funds to do this. And my understanding is a lot of these monuments it's a huge price to move them.
Oh yeah, it's a six-figure price.
So I don't know what happens if they can't raise the money, you know.
Well, Mayor Crewson has said she'll have a plan in a couple of weeks,
yeah,
so we'll
right.
see. I mean, she apparently is very interested in having
but
a thing
the ordinance does have an exception for things like that are within museums. Hmm. So it's not like you're completely erasing the history.
Well, it's 40 tons. I'm just picking it up and moving it down to Jefferson Barracks is going to be problematic, regardless of you know how much money they raise. Okay, moving on to another issue, a local issue. A federal judge has denied Missouri's request to stay his order, blocking two statewide abortion restrictions. Missouri claimed restrictions protect abortion patients' health. The judge said, and this is interesting, outstate women currently have three options: go to a distant clinic, self-abort, or seek a non-professional abortion, or have an unwanted birth. This goes back to the Texas case, which was decided
right.
by the
Whole
Supreme Court.
Health, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on that as to where that goes from here?
Yeah, I'm not surprised at all by the judge's decision. Missouri's law is very similar to the law struck down by the Supreme Court last year, and the law has had similar effects here in Missouri. So particularly for women who live in rural areas, the need to travel to St. Louis or urban areas in other states to access these services is a huge burden. And the evidence presented here just is that women's health is not being served by these laws.
You know, the Missouri Attorney General and the governor are just have an absurd position that is totally at odds with the Supreme Court on these kinds of requirements.
Interestingly, the state legislature during the recent not the special session but the recent session failed to act on a number of abortion bills. But there is some talk now that the governor might be persuaded to call yet another special session to deal with these and some other issues. So. We'll see. Maybe they'll try to correct some of this. We will see. A couple of other decisions that are from out of state but could have implications here, I think. There are two decisions that were made by the Supreme Court concerning issues in North Carolina. One is that the court refused to revive a restrictive North Carolina voting law that a federal appeals court said targeted African Americans. Proponents of the law was designed to counter voter fraud. It's an interesting case because voter identification is something we talk about a lot here. Also, there was a gerrymandering case in North Carolina where the court struck down two congressional district maps in that state claiming gerrymandering. Black North Carolina voters argued the plans packed African Americans in districts with a high percentage of African Americans, thus diluting their presence in other districts. Two interesting cases because these are things that we talk about a lot here. Are they likely to have an impact here? Can we sense that at this point? That this
well, this gerrymandering case—that's the one I'm more familiar with. The and I think this is sometimes surprising for people to find out, but it's okay to create congressional districts for a partisan benefit. So if we want to pack all the Democrats into three or four districts so we can get more Republicans, that's okay. But you can't. But you can't pack all the African Americans in one district to dilute. And in this case, they seem to be saying that because so many African American voters were Democrats, even though you say you were doing it for Democrats, you had this effect on African Americans. And it seems to be, to me, maybe suggesting some dilution of this what I or some have argued was an unlimited right to do partisan gerrymandering.
Mm-hmm. So
it could be a kink.
Right. So if you know, if your main reason to draw the districts the way you did is racial, then you have to have a really good reason for it. And about the only really good reason for it is, well, we had to do this to comply with the Voting Rights Act to enable blacks to elect more black officials. And that's what the North Carolina folks claimed. We just did this because the Voting Rights Act made us do it. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court, the Gore Court said, no, it was mainly for a racial reason, and you didn't have to do it to comply with the Voting Rights Act. So these two congressional districts, 1 and 12 in North Carolina, are unconstitutional racial gerrymanders.
Yeah, I agree that the distinction between race-based gerrymandering and partisan gerrymandering is a really important thing to watch from the opinion here. Right, for a long time, many states have, quite frankly, engaged in race-based gerrymandering, but said what they were doing was just trying to pack the Democrats into a few districts, right? They said they were trying to pack based on partisan affiliation. And I read the court here as trying to crack down on some of that, or at least opening the door to cracking down on some of that. So I think we'll be watching these cases closely going forward.
And Thomas joined in the majority opinion, which was kind of unusual. I mean,
I think he's always been against these, and now it just happens to be that the valence is in the other direction.
In the voter ID case, though, in North Carolina, some eyebrows were raised in that particular instance because the conservatives on the court basically went along with that.
Well, and you know, this is a different kettle of fish a little bit, because the Supreme Court did not issue an opinion in the voter ID law. They just said, we're not going to hear this. Mm-hmm. And Chief Justice Roberts said, the reason we're not going to, you know, don't be drawing big conclusions from this, because North Carolina couldn't figure out who even represented it before the Supreme Court. And because of all this confusion, you know, we're not even going to hear the case. So, you know, the effect in North Carolina is that the lower court decision is that threw out the voter ID law and other similar kinds of restrictions on African-American voting, that decision stands, but it doesn't apply anywhere else in the country.
Has now that the court is back to full strength, and I know that Justice Gorsuch has only been on the bench for a very short time, but have we seen anything yet to indicate what this new composition of the court is going to be producing? Is it too early? I mean, clearly everyone expects that he's going to be a conservative justice and that it's going to be pretty much as it was before Justice Scalia passed away.
Yeah, I think it's definitely too early. He was involved in one of the decisions they issued this morning, but it was a unanimous decision. So I certainly can't read anything from that. So, yeah, it's way too early to know, will he be like an Alito, really hardline conservative, or will he turn into more of a Kennedy in the middle of the court? We'll see.
I mean, I think so far, though, we've seen nothing to suggest he's not going to be an Alito or a Scalia, right?
I mean, I think that's right. From the questions he's been asking at oral argument, it seems like he's much more in that vein.
Right.
We have a couple of calls on issues that we've discussed. Let's bring them in. Most recently, we're talking about voter ID. So let's bring in Bob, calling from Millstadt over in Illinois. Bob, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to point out that in the North Carolina case, what made it unconstitutional was the fact that the legislature wanted to know the race of the voters involved, and that indicated that it was based on race and not on party affiliation.
All right, Bob, thanks for the call. Any response to that?
Well, I mean, it's correct that the lower courts that heard the trial decided that both districts had been gerrymandered based upon racial reasons, even though the North Carolina officials claimed that at least in one of them it was for partisan reasons, not racial reasons. So, yes, part of the finding was this is a racial gerrymander.
Okay, Bob, thanks for the call. Let's bring in Whitney, calling from Central West End. Go ahead, Whitney. You're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to thank you guys for giving these little legislative briefs that affect us locally. But I wanted to note, it was about 15 minutes ago now, but the discussion about the 8-foot barrier or sort of a bubble around the Planned Parenthood, I don't think you meant it to sound this way, but I wanted it to be noted explicitly that the majority of people who go to Planned Parenthood are both men and women, not seeking abortions or seeking to talk about abortions, but seeking information on or actual contraceptives, devices or pills, other basic health care needs, STD testing, et cetera.
Whitney, thank you. Yes, that's a distinction that we certainly would want to make, because that's exactly what goes on
right
over at that
good point.
Planned Parenthood. Thank you for the call. Another issue here, and time is beginning to wind down a little bit, but I wanted to talk about famous Senate Bill 5, which has been something we've talked about a lot with regard to the fines and fees in the municipalities. The Missouri Supreme Court upheld a lower bench ruling to limit revenue cities can derive from these traffic fines. The High Court agreed that a law restricting traffic fines in St. Louis County is unconstitutional. The law capped revenues at 12.5% for cities within the county, while 20% statewide. So it's an unfair application. Is that what we're talking about?
Right. So this was the main legislation that the legislature passed in reaction to Ferguson. They had set a 12.5% limit in St. Louis County and 20% for the rest of the state. The Missouri Supreme Court says that is a special law. Special laws are disfavored. The reason it's a special law is it only applies to St. Louis County. The way it was described, no other part of the state would be affected. When there's a special law is only can be constitutional if the state gives us good reasons for having a special law. The state gave no reasons to defend this as a special law. They claimed it wasn't a special law. And so the Supreme Court said, you know, we have a special law. There are no reasons offered by the state. So it's out. And the result is 20% will be the limit all across the state, including in St. Louis County. Now, the other part of that was thrown out is the requirement that St. Louis County police departments by a certain time become accredited and certain minimum standards for the police departments.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember here that the 20% cap now
right.
does apply, right?
Exactly.
Still within the county. So it's not as if there's no limit in St. Louis, just that there wasn't a special limit. But I understand the problem that the state is facing here, right? Particularly when there are as many municipalities as we have in the county. No one area is really accountable to another, and we can run into problems fairly quickly. And this is not the first time the state has had to make general laws because particular municipalities want to either encourage certain activities within their jurisdictions or prevent them. So I'm a property professor, and I know that lots of municipalities want to zone out particular kinds of uses, like substance abuse treatment facilities, and the state has had to pass laws saying that you can't always do that.
One interesting thing about this case was, as Bill said, you can have this difference, these different or special rules if there's a justification. But apparently no justification was offered. And so when the press talked to Hawley, he said, well, this was argued by Koster. And then they went to Koster, who then said, well, you got to talk to the lawyer who argued it. And then he didn't return any calls. So there's a question about why. I mean, because I think, was it Senator Schmidt who passed it?
Yes.
Yeah. And he was saying, look, we had some good statistical evidence for why. Now, who knows if it would have worked or not. But I think the takeaway is exactly what Rachel and Bill said, which is even though the 12.5 was struck down, we still get that 20%, which is going to be a change.
I mean, certainly there could have been very strong evidence offered. I mean, there was the
yeah.
Justice Department report about how
right, right.
the Ferguson Municipal Court was used as a cash register and basically in an unconstitutional manner to use traffic stops of African Americans and other poor people to raise money for city expenses.
I'm a little confused. We only have a few seconds left with regard to what happens now. Does law have to be amended, or is this simple court?
The 20% is
20% goes in place.
The Supreme Court made very clear 20% applies every place.
All righty. Well, that would seem to be that. Any other final thoughts as we get ready to say
well,
goodbye?
Well, just another thing with differences. You know, City of St. Louis tried to get a minimum wage of $10.
Oh,
the state
right.
came in and said, no, you can't do that. But what's interesting is the city's law is effective now. State law doesn't become effective till the end of August. So you're going to have minimum wage in the City of St. Louis for a three-month period being $10 and then reverting to whatever it is, $7.70 or $7.35,
Between it is. $7 and $7.50, I think. Okay, that does it for us today. That was Mark Smith, you just heard from Washington University. Also with me in studio is Rachel Sachs of Washington University School of Law. And also the third party in the studio is Bill Freivogel from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Thank you all so much for being with us for another good discussion on this Tuesday, the day after Memorial Day. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at a new documentary about the history of the Central West End. And we'll get an update on area restaurant openings and closings from Sauce Magazine experts. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.